I'm David Paul. We have an interesting show for you this morning. Astoria Film Festival, it's that time of year again, and then later on the Death Cafe. But first, the Astoria International Film Festival, and here to talk about it for this year is the executive director of the film festival, Ron Craig. Ron, thanks for stopping by this morning.
My pleasure.
How long have you been doing it, the film festival, Ron?
Let's see. The fall of the Roman Empire was, yeah. This is our eighth year of being involved.
The eighth annual.
Yeah, and it's, people look, well, what do you attribute that to as far as the longevity? In today's life, longevity is 3 years. A lot of it is involved with the community here as far as their support of the festival itself. And like I said, it's a passion, a labor of love to be able to put it together.
And, there are a lot of people in this community who love independent films, and I think it would support an art house, but until an art house, we have the International Film Festival. Let's take a look and see what's what you got this year.
We start the festival. It runs through 3 days, the 17th, 18th, and 19th of October, which is just around the corner. We're going to open at 5:30 on Friday with GMOOMG, which primarily deals with genetically modified foods and labeling. And it's, for me, it's really kind of as far as facilitating the information or channeling the information to people about this. It's going to be actually on the Oregon ballot this November.
Yeah, hot topic right now, yeah. Measure 92.
Yeah, for me, it's not even a pro or con position. It's more the fact of people having information and knowing, what's available.
So that's going to be the very first film in the festival on the 17th, and that's going to be followed up by 20 Feet from Stardom. This is one I've always wanted to see since I heard about it, since I read about it, about backup singers.
Music people, period, enjoy music, but a lot of times they really don't understand, like session musicians and stuff think of groups like, the Motown days. There were a lot of very talented musicians that were behind these groups who, as they say, the doo-wop people or the ya-ya-ya people. Well, this 20 Feet from Stardom deals with basically the 60s and 70s as far as a lot of the backup singers, and they pretty much highlight Darlene Love, who was a backup. That Darlene Love, who was a backup singer for a number of groups, and the alt groups. They also highlight this as far as Sting comments about this, and a number of other noted performers as far as what the support that these backup singers brought to their endeavors.
When I think backup singers, I think of I believe it was Mary Clayton who sang that incredible wailing solo on the Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter.
Absolutely. And they deal with that. Mick Jagger, he is just mixes, he's as far as mixing, what it was all about, he says this is it, And I think when it comes from those sources that I think the people out here that are listening, they understand about it.
And then, again, on a musical note, we have The Winding Stream.
Yes. That's a film by a local filmmaker, Beth Harrington, and Beth is a very talented filmmaker. She's done a number of films for PBS, OPB. She's done Birvana. I think we showed that year and stuff. She's also done most recently a documentary on Reed College, which, like I say, once again, a regional sort of experience. The Winding Stream is a documentary has been very near and dear to her heart. She and I actually worked on a project back in 2008 on York, and that's when we first met and realized the talent that she brought to the table and stuff. But it deals with the Carter Cash legacy as far as their music family. And she had one of the last interviews with Johnny Cash before he passed away. So it's very, very insightful as far as what the Carter Cash family brought to the table as far
tremendous
as American
impact.
Music.
Yeah, tremendous impact. And that rounds out the first day, the 17th.
Right, yeah. And it goes from about 9. We usually finish up on Friday at about 10:30. And so it's one of those things that we kind of open with films that we think people would really a magnet to bring them here on a Friday after work.
Mm-hmm. Is there any sort of a discussion about the films when they're
We're going to be able, as far as we typically like to get people, direct them to some of the local establishments, as far as coffee houses and little bistros, as far as discussion after a little coffee or a little bit of wine always gets the tongue wagging on some of the controversial, more controversial
yeah,
issues.
Yeah, it certainly does. Has a tendency to do that. Yeah. That's right. Okay, then we head into the weekend on Saturday, and 11 o'clock in the morning, the best of the 40th Northwest Filmmakers Festival. Talk
we've
a little
had
a, bit about that.
We've had a relationship with the Northwest Film Center for since day one, and we're working on different projects with them. But I always try to bring them into the loop because they are really one of the main providers of some of the young talent and talent around the Northwest, which includes Oregon, Washington, Idaho primarily, and some of Northern California. But they always bring sort of a smorgasbord of films, and I think where it's all capsulized into 1 hour and 15 minute film.
So these are shorts.
Yes, they're basically short. The longest one being about 15 minutes, but it's definitely it's a very captivating.
So that's at 11, and that runs until about 12:20 p.m.
Yeah.
And then at 12:30, Anita, and Anita here being Anita Hill. Gosh, how many years ago was that now when she brought allegations of sexual harassment against then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas, and the hearings that ensued, and Howell Heflin famously said, "Are you a woman scorned?" And Joe Biden and Ted Kennedy,
our vice president,
now our vice president. Yes, it was. And you know what? In Alan Simpson, and yeah, I think it really highlighted at the time. It really brought to light at the time how clueless a lot of men are about the prevalence of sexual harassment. And she paid a pretty high price for bringing those allegations.
Absolutely. A sidelight, we actually tried to get her here, and our budget didn't allow us to have, because she does lecture around the country. For me, it was one of those things. There's a couple of different notes real quickly here on that. Number one is the fact that the realization that the millennials, millennium people, as far as an age bracket, have no idea who Anita Hill is. And the fact of the importance she played in this whole role. And I've had to kind of direct people to let them know that even though it was an African-American that was being nominated for Supreme Court, and also there was an African-American woman who was involved in it, that it's less that, it's more the fact of our history and what the system, how it works or doesn't work. And I think for me, it was an opportunity to put this on the front from a historical perspective and let people draw their own conclusions. But as I say, it's a bunch of, and this is not my words necessarily, but a bunch of old white guys. And
yes,
these black, and, you know, this high, was it, Clarence Thomas's line, paraphrasing, high-tech lynching.
Yes, I remember that.
So people can make their assessment. And the other note out of the fact that with the reality TV shows, this is within the industry, two things that push the reality show concept was the fact of the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas, and also the O.J. Simpson. Because
if
you talk to anybody of a generation, where were you when Anita Hill spoke of a Coke can? Oh, I was this way, you know, and did you see the white Bronco?
They would immediately recognize that reference you just made, what that meant. Well, then that's Anita at 2:30, Little White Lie.
Yeah, that was one that came to me through a colleague, and it was about a young woman who was born into a Jewish family, and the deception in which goes with the name as far as a little white lie is the fact that her family had told her, because if she had a olive skin or darker skin, that it was due to a fact of one of her European relatives, and it came through in the gene pool. But the short of it is that her mother had had an affair early on with an African-American co-worker, and the father knew it and the mother knew it, and she was the daughter. And so she didn't know, the realization that she was actually African-American or part African-American didn't come about, and she was maybe 15 or 16 years of age, and how it sort of, after she confronted her parents about it and the denial, it's very interesting. It's one of those things, I think people, it shows what had affected her, and as not so much as a survivor, but the fact of how she emotionally prospered by it and still lectures on it. And it's an elegant film.
And then some, S-O-M-M, it's a look into the world of master sommeliers, wine stewards.
Well, yeah, and I think that, you know, especially in this area, you know, the Northwest, you know, even more targeted as far as Astoria, we're enough foodies around here to understand, you know, you go to a place and may look on a corner or something, they'll pull out a wine list that has, you know, 50 wines on it. Whoa, what's this about? Well, it's part of it as far as the enjoyment of wine with a meal, but it's not even a technical thing because the people who are involved in this at the level as far as being wine masters, it's quite involved and it's a life's course that they go mm-hmm. on and to be able to achieve these levels. And, you know, it's not revealing, you know, and not revealing the whole total story is it's just, it's one of those things that it puts you in a position of saying, oh, so that's what happened as far as the selection of this wine. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
An inside look at an occupation. Then we have the winding stream again, and then mm-hmm. Big Joy.
Big Joy, it deals with, shall we say, the beat generation. It's very, how else we can say, it's almost kind of difficult for me to really put a total title on it, but it chronicles a number of different avenues in the early 50s as far as with the beat generation. And it deals with some adult texts and matters and stuff, so I don't want to really want to go down the course with this and stuff at this time, but it's a very, I recommend people go online, Astoria International Film Festival, and as far as being, each one of the films has a short synopsis, and to find out which films they feel that are going to be able to address what they like to see.
And a special this year is a kind of a salute to that classic film, Some Like It Hot.
Well, yeah, it's of a generation growing up and seeing this film, and it was one of those things that a lot of times people Netflix and different avenues as far as looking at films, older films. I was in my local Movie Madness in Portland and stuff, which has a great selection of old films, and all of a sudden that started talking to me, and I grabbed it, and I said, because I always like to do some sort of feature film that's a classic and stuff, and you think about Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe, mm-hmm. It is considered one of the funniest films ever, and what we're hoping to do, or we're going to do, we'll have an event with Hipfish, which we kind of have where people come and there's their favorite character. We're scheduled that for Saturday. And
what time is that going to be?
We're looking at probably about 8 o'clock on uh-huh. Saturday evening and stuff. It'll be listed on the website and also in Hipfish as far as the issue when it comes out tomorrow, I think it is. But it's one of those incredible experiences and stuff that we look at these characters. So obviously, they're not with us, and Joey Brown and stuff. And it deals with issues that people are like, well, how did they do this? And there was, you know, when you look at it as far as being able to get the film out there, because a lot of the people didn't want it to air.
Well, but, yeah, at the time, the gender switching.
Absolutely.
That was a. Yeah. That was kind of groundbreaking at the time.
It was more than groundbreaking. It was disturbing to some people.
It was scandalizing at
absolutely.
The time. Let's go ahead and say it.
I love scandal.
Now, tickets. How do people go about getting tickets?
Primarily what they do, they can either go the day of the show, they can the box office at Liberty Theater.
And that's going to be the primary venue this year or this whole
year? Yes, it'll be the Liberty Theater. We also... we'll be showing Some Like It Hot as a backdrop at the event for Some Like It Hot. Tickets West, also, they'll be able to get them from there.
So folks can get it online by going to your website, I would
imagine.
Right,
absolutely. So it's pretty readily available. We do have on Sunday at 11:30, we have what we call croissants and coffee. And that's at 11:30 on Sunday morning, where it's free, and we provide croissants and coffee and gives people opportunity to kind of talk about the films they've seen over the last Friday and Saturday, and then we go into Sunday with the films. And it's just a kind of a low-key deal on a Sunday morning after brunch and stuff. But yeah, it's we're very, very proud to be able to present these films here to the community, and we've been able to move where we have people coming from other areas, for the Seattle, Portland, as far as making it a destination. Because, you know, on a more personal side, Astoria is an incredible destination. And I think once I've gotten people here for the film festival, they tend to come back. Yeah.
Visit us again.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, like I said, it's so much here to be able to experience.
Well, Ron Craig, Executive Director of the Astoria International Film Festival, always a pleasure. And we'll see you at the movies.
I'll be there in front row.
We're going to take a brief break now, and then when we come back, the Death Cafe.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Talk of Our Towns here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN in Astoria, 89.5 KTCB in Tillamook. We're live on the web at coastradio.org. I'm David Paul. A lot of people call the summer of 1967 the summer of love. Well, for me, it was a summer of loss. I was just shy of my 12th birthday. My father went in for a routine physical. They found a spot on his lung, and within a month, he'd passed away. It's all very sudden. And, of course, those experiences are seared in my memory, but one thing that really stands out was the response of my schoolmates that fall when I went back to school. They avoided me. They were just so uneasy about dealing with death. It was as if I had some sort of contagious disease. They avoided me, and it wasn't until months later when they saw that I wasn't going to bring it up that they began to... begin to deal with me again. There's an international movement in the last few years that has sprung up to destigmatize the subject of death in Western cultures, and the Death Cafe, and it's coming to Astoria. And here to talk about it is the facilitator of Death Cafe Astoria, Phil Morgan. Phil, thanks for stopping by.
Good morning, David.
In a nutshell, give us the history and the genesis of the Death Cafes.
It started in England. In London, there was a guy named John Underwood who in 2010 was reading some information by Bernie Katz. And he got excited about the possibility of having conversations about death. So he invited some people over to his house, and they sat around talking about issues, and it expanded from there. In 2011, they had their first formal meeting and wrote a guideline to having the Death Cafe. It got called Death Cafe because they had tea and cake during the time that they were talking together. And... the movement started in 2012, the first death cafe outside of the UK. It was started in the United States. Since then, there's about 1,200 death cafes happening all the time.
Throughout around the world?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's really taken on a life of its own, so to speak, for a death subject.
And you got involved at the Death Cafes in Portland, I believe.
I did. Last year, I had the opportunity to go to some death cafes in Portland. There are several. There are about five different death cafes happening in the Portland area. There's one called the Portland Death Cafe, and I got involved in that, attended a couple of the others, and... really enjoyed the people that were coming and the conversations that were happening at those things. It's a very open-ended forum for people who want to discuss issues about death.
So if we were to attend a Death Cafe, what could we expect to see? How would it proceed?
I can tell you about the one here, because sometimes the formats are different depending on who's doing
the organizing. It's pretty free form, and
yeah. Yeah. You'll come into the Astoria Senior Center over off of West Marine Drive. You'll join with other people that are there. You'll divide up into tables of about four or five people. You'll introduce yourself to the people at the table and tell them who you are and why you decided to come. And from that, conversations will begin about death. Either they'll arise from the introductions, what people shared, or we'll have a menu on the table.
A menu?
Yes.
And you've brought
of course,
one of those
menus.
I have one of those menus right in front of me here, the Astoria Death Cafe menu. First item, how would you complete the statement, death is blank?
Right.
That's a pretty open-ended.
We try and keep it open-ended as far as the questions.
What factors in your life lead you to feel about death the way you do? Here's a before I die, I want to. There's your classic bucket list right there.
Right.
What do you want it done with your body after you're dead? You know, that's
yeah, it's a big it's question. Nice for us to make our own choice instead of dumping it on somebody else.
And what would you like written on your headstone? There are two columns.
Well, they're the same.
We'll
we'll cut the menu in half. But it's just to get people start to get thinking about these things and get comfortable talking about it. There's such a fear in our society, and you experience that as a child. You don't know how to deal with folks. You don't know how to deal with people that are dealing with loss, whether it's a death or of a loved one, a death of a pet, after a serious accident, after a diagnosis of a life-threatening illness. Those kinds of things we kind of pull back from.
People don't like to talk about it.
Right. They're uncomfortable.
And the Death Cafe is a place where you can.
They can get comfortable. Yes. Yeah. And there's no pressure. One of the things I really like is the guidelines that come down from John and that we have to subscribe to in order to call ourselves a death cafe. And there are four very simple guidelines. There's no intention of leading participants to any conclusion, product, or course of action. It is an open, respectful, confidential space where people can express their views safely. It is a not-for-profit basis, and alongside refreshing drinks and nourishing food. So
there's always tea and cake,
yeah,
I understand, at a death cafe.
There's always tea and cake. In our case, we'll have coffee, too. And I encourage people, it's a potluck sort of thing for the treats, so I encourage people to bring things that they like to have and share with others.
Now, in your experience, Phil, how what kind of mood has prevailed at death cafes?
Relief.
Relief, yeah.
Relief. And people get excited about the possibility that they can actually sit down with other people and that they don't know and talk about
a taboo subject.
Yeah. And we encourage people when they come in to sit at a table where they don't know anybody. We find that it's more comfortable for them to talk about the subjects if they aren't intimately familiar with the other people at the table. And they can go out after the death cafe and they can share their...
Continue the conversation
with their friends. Yeah.
Now, how did you get involved in death? What drew you to death cafes in the first place?
Well, where do we want to start?
Well,
my father was a funeral director.
That'll do it.
So that was kind of my introduction. And so we...
You were desensitized early on.
I was. And our living space was upstairs over the funeral home. And one of my jobs was to go out with Dad and pick up the people that were... We were being brought back to the mortuary, and I threw some great Halloween parties.
I'll bet you did.
that kind of started the ball rolling. And then I got involved. I had a neighbor who had gotten seriously ill, and I got involved in supporting the development of the Mid-Willamette Valley Hospice, which was the first community hospice in Oregon. And then got involved in hospice programs, started a program for helping people with life-threatening illness, got involved in NODA, the No One Dies Alone program.
Talk about that a little bit.
It's a program that was developed, I don't know how long ago, but it's nationwide, and it's run here in the area by Columbia Memorial Hospital. And it's a bunch of volunteers who are willing to just go in and sit with somebody who's dying and not do anything necessarily with them. Most of the people that I've worked with were in a coma by the time I got to sit with them. So it was just a way of making sure that the person who was dying had somebody there with them. They weren't dying alone. And a way for the family to feel like, oh, I can take a little bit of a break from this. So that sometimes it was just a matter of I would come in, they go get some dinner and have some conversations of their own, and they'd come back a couple hours later, and somebody or another volunteer would come in after.
Knowing that their loved one wasn't.
So it's not about any agenda or talking to them or anything. Sometimes I'd take a book along with me to read, or I would just sit there sometimes and hold their hand if they were comfortable with that. So it was, yeah.
Now, in the typical, I don't know if you can say there is a typical death cafe, but in your experience, what has been the age groups?
Let's see. I think I've seen some kids there about 9 or 10 years old, and some of them were over 90. So,
So it runs the spectrum.
It does. It does. And it's because we all need to talk about that. If we're not comfortable talking about death, we're not comfortable with life. There's this piece of us that can't get expressed, and we hold back. And when we hold back, we don't fully involve ourselves in life.
I saw on the website, the Death Cafe website, that the aim is to enable people to live life more fully.
Yes, absolutely.
Be more authentic.
Right. Yeah. And having that freedom to talk about the taboo subjects gives us a lot more freedom to live our life.
Again, now, when is this going to be coming up in Astoria?
It will be Tuesday, October 14th, 5:30 to 7 at the
5:30 to 7
Senior Center over on West, it's the old Yacht Club, the temporary Senior Center.
Mm-hmm. And is it your aim to have regular Death Cafe meetings after this?
I plan on doing one again in January if this one works out, and then we'll see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll do it either every 3 months or every couple months, depending on what the interest is.
And how can people find out more about the Death Cafes?
They can email me at astoriadeathcafe@earthlink.net.
Astoria Death Cafe at earthlink.net.
Yes.
So, if you want to broach the end of life, it also said that it's not a grief counseling session.
It's not a grief counseling. It's not a it's not a therapy session, and it's not something where we have a speaker that comes in and tells you about some aspect of dying. It's about having conversations about what's important to you in your heart. And
typically different conversations at each table.
Different conversations at each table, yes. And a break in the middle to go get the tea and cake.
Then the cake. Well, Phil, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about the Astoria Death Cafe. Again, that's going to be on the 14th.
14th, 5:30 to 7.
At the Old Yacht Club out on Marine Drive in Astoria.
Absolutely.
There you go.
Great.
Couldn't be more topical.
Fantastic.
And that's about all the time we have for Talk of Our Towns this morning. Phil Morgan, facilitator of Astoria Death Cafe, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, David.
Be sure to take in some films at the International Film Festival, folks, starting up on the 17th. Thank you, Terry Wilson, for engineering this morning. As always, I'm David Paul. Stay tuned next week for another edition of Talk of Our Towns.
You've been listening to Talk of Our Towns with your host, David Paul. Talk of Our Towns is heard every Wednesday morning at 9:30. If you came in late to this program, you can hear it all on our website, coastradio.org. Just click on the Talk of Our Towns program information box on the homepage. You can hear any of our locally produced public affairs shows, plus get information on our program schedule at coastradio.org. KMUNAstoria.org. Right now you are listening to Coast Community Radio, KMUN Astoria 91.9 FM, and KTCB Tillamook 89.5 FM, and live streaming on the web at coastradio.org. Miss Kerry Gallagher will stop by right after some NPR news headlines for 2 hours of folk music on her show she calls Acoustic Brunch. The forecast for Astoria and the coast, partly cloudy, highs 65 to 70, lows around 55. Currently on the front porch, it is 60 degrees, and on the south slope, it's 55 degrees.
How are collective and personal narratives revised? Do we need a new vocabulary? On the next Alternative Radio, tune in for feminist author Rebecca Solnit on Making and Breaking Stories. That's Alternative Radio, Thursday afternoon at 3, right here on KMUN Astoria and KTCB Tillamook.
And we've got 9 seconds before the news on Coast Community Radio, and here it comes right now.